Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Show number 8. We're almost getting into the double digits.
We are. We're getting there.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we didn't have a show last week because Nick was out of town.
I was indeed. Apologies, guys. I went to go update the Twitter and realized that I don't think I know the password for the Twitter account. So I don't know what you're doing over there, Nikhil, but... anyway, so apologies for the silence. It was all Nikhil's fault.
Well, you can have it back for $50,000.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Thank you. That you're gonna troll me or whatever. So you're gonna hack the rest of my accounts.
That's right.
All
right.
Yeah. So I was out of town last week. I was in sunny, beautiful Orlando, Florida. I was attending the HIMSS 2014 Conference and Trade Show. So for those of you who are not involved in the realm of clinical informatics, HIMSS stands for the Health Information Management Systems Society. Yes, there's a reason why they just call it HIMSS. And basically what it is, it's one of the largest health IT trade shows. I think it's the largest in the world. They had a record number of attendees this year, about 38,000 people.
Oh my God.
Of which 12,000 of those were registered as exhibitors and vendors.
That's a lot of competition.
It is a lot of competition. This show is so big that there are only 3 convention centers in the U.S. that can hold it. Not just because of the number of people, but because of the size of the exhibit floor.
And they're all management system vendors?
They are all. It's basically general health IT. So it spans a wide range. So Stanley was there showing off some of their equipment. Stanley, the people that make like the drills and stuff. Okay. They were there showing off some of their hardware for operating rooms. Philips Healthcare was there showing off some of their, basically their integrated like EKG and vital machines that you can tie in with your informatics network. But in general, the big cornerstone were companies like Cerner and Epic, IBM and NextGen that were showing off EHRs or related systems.
Wow.
And so everybody there has these, you know, these huge booths, and there's just a ton of money that gets pumped into this thing. At this convention center, which is just massive, this show this year set the record for the amount of power utilized, the amount of data sent over their networks, and the amount of rigging that they used to hang all this stuff from the ceiling. They actually had to go out and procure additional hanging supplies and rigs.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so it is. It's mind-blowing. I think it's even more mind-blowing coming from an academic standpoint, where if you go to a conference that has 200 people, that's a pretty good-sized conference.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from like the big, you know, like AMIA, the American Medical Informatics Association, or some of the big discipline conferences, a conference on decision-making or high-performance databases will be less than 200 people. And then you go to this kind of conference, and it's just massive.
Yeah, but that just goes to show. I mean, like, how many people did you actually get to network with out there? I mean, with that many people, I would imagine that you wouldn't really get to meet anybody.
You know, so I was a little bit lucky where I was working. I was working as a program assistant, so I was a volunteer at the conference, and so they offer this program that they open up to graduate students in informatics or those related fields. And you come down, they give you free conference, free hotel, and food, basically, and then they work you to the bone. So I was assigned into the tote bag distribution. So I was working in the registration area, and so people would come to me to get their free swag bags. So I actually got to interact and network with quite a few people. There were a couple people that I met. I met John Halomka. He's the geek doctor. He's the CIO of Beth Israel Deaconess, or that big medical center in Boston. And I met and chatted with him for a few minutes. Met a couple different organizations, exchanged some cards, that kind of stuff. But one of the things that was really cool was everybody would come up to me and they'd hand me their badge. And so I would look at their badge, and I'd be able to see, because I had to check, I would have to scan it in to give them their bag and check to make sure that they were a registered attendee. And so I get to look at their name, any titles that they had, you know, PhD, MS, or something like that. And then their official title at the company, and then the company they worked for. And so that was actually really cool to be able to get kind of, you know, an informal sampling of a lot of what people actually do in the world of healthcare.
Well, that is interesting. So, I mean, I've heard that there are not very many PhDs.
There are not many at all.
So that's very interesting to actually hear that you can confirm that by mm-hmm. doing a kind of a cursory glance at this list.
Yeah, there were very few of them. There were a couple who had, you know, titles like architect, like systems architect, or research scientists or something like that, that were then working for a commercial, you know, commercial vendor or something like that, which is really cool because I think that would be a really interesting space to play in as somebody with an informatics background, with an interest in research, but also building, you know, practical and applied systems.
Yeah, it's the fun stuff.
It is. But, you know, what's really interesting is you look at it and you're walking through this convention center and you're just kind of in the middle of all this and you realize that this is what drives healthcare. I think as academics, we cherish what we do very highly, and rightly we should. We do lots of really interesting things. And I think that there's this perception that this is what's driving the future of healthcare. And to some extent, that's true. But in reality, what's driving the future of healthcare is not all the papers that are being published. It's the ones that IBM and Epic are reading.
Right. That makes sense.
And so I think that there's a really good niche. And it's small, but I think there could be a really interesting niche for people who are trained as scientists and researchers to go and work for vendors and basically translate the algorithms and the methodologies that are being developed in academia and translating those into systems that have direct clinical applications and impact on patients' lives and on healthcare in general.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, so it was really fun to be able to see that and to confirm it. I met a lot of really interesting people in the healthcare world in general, and you know, a lot of students working on their master's in informatics or master's health administration, all sorts of different things. And it's interesting. This coming crop of students right now, there's a lot of really good people that are coming to the forefront, and I'm pretty excited about that in the future of really understanding technology as a tool and sort of as a normalcy in daily life and integrating that into healthcare. They're going to bring with them a whole different set of buy-in requirements that I think is really going to drive some change in the floor.
That's good. That's really good. Mm-hmm. It's about time.
Yeah.
For positive change. Nick, really quickly, I wanted to ask you, when it comes to the EMRs, since you've seen like the state of the art EMRs, mm-hmm. right now, are any of them or have any of them improved their user interface?
No.
So they still look ugly as sin and are yeah. difficult to use. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not very...
There are a few little companies that are pushing in that direction. One of the things that's interesting in that you see is healthcare still is very much on the guild mentality. The mindset that there are professional organizations, nurses, physicians, and this kind of stuff. So it has, in a sense, not an old boys club, but pedigree matters. If you're not an MD, you have a limited ability to speak into the clinical side of medicine, right? That you stay on the administrative or the research side, but this is what the clinicians do, and this is different. If you don't come from healthcare in general, it's difficult for you to break in to even the organization, the management side of things.
Yep, and we've seen that.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I think you see is that places that are getting, quote-unquote, disrupted, or places where you're seeing really interesting changes in user interfaces and design and this kind of stuff, those, I think, I saw a little bit of them trying to break into the healthcare space, and obviously with very limited success. Why? Because they're not healthcare. Because they are technology in general, or they are quote-unquote startup culture. And that doesn't integrate very well with healthcare in general.
So ironic, because I would say that a hospital works just like a startup. It's constantly changing on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Things are always falling apart, and you're always trying to fix it.
But a hospital is a professional organization, a professional entity, and you have to, and it works on the apprenticeship model. That's fundamentally what it's built on. And so you have places that are trying to come in, and if they don't fit with that culture, then it's difficult to make inroads. So whereas companies like Cerner and Epic and even Caradigm, the company over here in Bellevue, is they've earned that right. And so part of what that comes with is building systems that fit into the way you do healthcare and the way that these things are done. And I think we're going to start seeing a shift with that over the next few years, but we're not there yet. And I think now, as we're moving more, that things like the accountable care organizations and different ways that we're structuring healthcare now is going to shift away, I think, from, and this is just my opinion, but I think we're going to see a shift away from primarily clinical-driven hospitals, where hospitals are defined by the medicine that they do, to more professional organizations that are run as businesses or as different entities. And that's going to bring a different set of requirements to the forefront and a different prioritization, so it'll be easier to break in some areas. And
Interesting.
Those others, yeah.
I would imagine, so from my point of view, I was thinking that hospitals already are businesses. Like, they're, at the end of the day, yes, they do serve people and make them feel better, and heal them, but at the same time, they do have to make a bottom line because they are a business. And it would be in their benefit to basically, you know, make more money, and they can make more money by helping their doctors serve people better with better user interfaces. So to me, that is something that makes sense. But at the same time, I can see that they're afraid that if there's a big change in their system, then things are going to fall apart and they're not going to be able to serve people as well as they are at the moment. Like, their baseline is going to drop. And if their baseline drops, they're going to start losing patients, which means they're going to be losing money. And they're also going to be liable. So it's like they can't really make mistakes, because if they do make mistakes, not only will they lose money that they would have gotten, but they're also going to be sued.
Yeah.
So there's a big, you know, slap on the wrist for that sort of a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've hit on a lot of good insights. It's healthcare is in an odd flux right now. I mean, we are not that far away from what is the famous case is Schloendorf v. State or New York or something like that, where basically was when you were allowed to question your doctor, right? We are just moving out of that now. And so we're seeing these shifts in healthcare from the way that we've done things for so long. And so even though hospitals are kind of organizations, they're businesses, they operate with a different... It's not they operate differently, but that the bottom line is not the return on investment. It's not... It's a different priority set. Mm-hmm. And I think business is starting to shift very slowly to starting to recognize that as a genuine interest.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about places like... Whole Foods... They have their like six stakeholder like criteria or whatever. So they define their success metrics are based on not just stock performance, but on their stakeholders are not just their stockholders. It's also their customers and their suppliers and their employees and the environment, their community or the environment. And like it's something like they have like their list that they do. And so we're seeing that shift in business in general, and that aligns very well with how where healthcare kind of already is.
Yeah, I agree. Like Amazon and Whole Foods, I think if they are taking all of their stakeholders into account, and not, you know, say they don't even take into account their stockholders, what's going to end up happening is people are going to keep buying from Whole Foods or keep buying from Amazon, and they're going to have a good cash flow. And as long as they have a cash flow, that's what matters. Like if they have a good cash flow, the stock's going to keep flying up. So... indirectly, the stockholders will benefit as long as they keep selling.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. And that's what we're starting to see this a little bit. And this is kind of what I love. This is what I love about business and since some of these market dynamics is that you get the opportunity to test stuff like this. And Whole Foods is showing that it works. And in a sense, Apple, to some extent, is showing that it works. They've been much more, they're usually more towards the front on doing, especially environmental impact and stuff like that. Not great, not flawless, but they're a little bit further advanced, and obviously it hasn't hurt their stock price at all. And so you're seeing companies are starting to prove that you can do this model, it isn't just about the bottom line. But making that distinction doesn't come really, you're not really sacrificing. You're not committing to negative returns or, you know, just one piddly returns. You're still committing to being a profitable and efficient company. But that you're recognizing that the role of business is in to promote, you know, human flourishing and all these kinds of things. So,
have you heard about Keurig, what they've done lately
with the DRM?
Yeah,
I heard a little bit about this. So what is going on?
So my understanding is that Keurig's new machine is going to only take Keurig K cups. So if you get your K cups from a different manufacturer, someone cheaper perhaps, it's not going to work anymore. And to boot. You know, the K-cups that Keurig makes are still not compostable. So, I don't know. I don't know what to think about all this. So far, it seems like I don't want to use any more Keurig stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to get my own beans and grind them myself and make my own cup of coffee with my AeroPress. But
well, you should be doing that anyways.
Well, I'm trying to. I just don't have time. I think actually the people next to me who are not in our department, who I sit next to, they would be very ticked off if I kept grinding beans.
Put it in
at my desk.
That's so. Just put the grinder in the kitchen.
That's something to consider.
So I'll run a little tangent, but then I want to get back to this because this is an interesting topic.
Sure.
So my coffee in the morning is, you know, is like grind it, you know, hot water, and I use a French press. And so it actually doesn't take a whole lot of time. So I get up in the morning, and I immediately go to the kitchen, and I put the hot water kettle on. And so I set that to boil. And I have one of the Bonavita variable temp. So I set the temperature, and it holds it for me. Then I go and take my shower, and I come out, and I start the brew process. And so I measure out my beans, I weigh out my beans, grind it, throw it in the French press, and then start the brew process. That takes less than 5 minutes. And I have a full French press full of water.
It's the grinding part that sucks, though.
Yes. Why does it suck for you, Nikhil?
Well, I have a manual coffee mill grinder.
Yes, you do.
So it does. It's still noisy, though.
Like, yeah, it is very noisy.
I don't mind actually doing it. It's just like the noise is what gets to people. Because people have complained to me that, hey, you know, it's 6 in the morning. Stop grinding coffee.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So
you know what you should do when we go on our trip when we go to Vancouver on Saturday, mm-hmm. you and the lady should just come over to the house and we'll make some coffee before we go.
That
you can see how I do it.
Awesome.
And since then you just park in my place and we'll go from there. But
perfect.
Cool.
Perfect.
All right. Anyways, back to the K-Cup thing. A little tangent there. So I was, funny story, I was at Microsoft a couple months ago. I have a friend who's a program manager in the linguistics group. And we were kind of going around and, you know, seeing things. They have all the different little machines. Or they have, like, not the Keurig machines, but something like it. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember what the brand was, like Galvani or whatever. And
that's a cheese. Galvani.
Galvani. No. What's that? Gavali? Is it Gavali? I don't know. Anyways, it was some other brand. And it was a commercial machine. Mm-hmm. And so they could buy their, like, get the K-Cups and bring them in. But they just stocked, like, really simple ones. So my friend went to Sam's Club and bought a big package of these machines, of these packets from, like, all different, you know, like your variety pack from Keurig, like all sorts of things.
Sure.
And so she brought them in, and they didn't work from the machine because they weren't the commercial variety.
Right.
And she looked at it, and there was a difference in the packaging that the machine was obviously reading and refusing to work.
Could she hack it? Did she try even?
She didn't try and hack it. Again, she's a linguist, not like a developer. I mean, if it had been you or me, we would have been like...
spending hours trying to figure out how to get it to work.
Yeah, exactly.
Just because we're so lazy to drive the stuff back to Costco and return it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No. It's not about being too lazy. It's the principle of the matter, right?
Well, that too.
That's what this thing with the K-Cup is. Not that Keurig doesn't have, in a sense, a right to an interest in vertically integrating. But it's the principle of, like, freaking DRM on my coffee. Like, I was reading an article on ours about this, and the funny thing was somebody posted one of those promoted comments was, I wonder if their DRM is it just shuts off if it smells the aroma of real coffee. So what do you think about this, though, as just a matter of smart business or intelligent strategy or anything like this? Do you think this is a good idea for them, like, just business-wise or strategically?
I don't know. I think, you know, they must have had some guy run some numbers and figure out that they're losing a lot of money, where they could be making money with K-Cups, because people are actually buying them from different manufacturers now instead of ordering them from Keurig themselves. But I don't know if that's going to, you know, at the end of the day, that just kind of leaves a bitter taste in your mouth as a customer. So I just don't know if it, you know, overall is a positive thing. I guess we're just going to have to sort of let things pan out a bit and see how they go. But as of now, you know, the Keurig cups are definitely more expensive. I pay half the price. Like, on Amazon, they actually have mm-hmm. K-Cups from different manufacturers which work on the Keurig machines right now. And those are wonderful. I mean, it's still shitty coffee. And it's, you know, if I can pay half price for shitty coffee, just coffee that's just as shitty, then, you know, wonderful. I'll do that. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see how things pan out.
Yeah. So I'm looking at their stock price right now and looking at over the 1 month. And right around the 21st, we started to see a slow decrease in their stock. Not a plummet. So now I can look at it. Remember, let me see if I can find this. There we go. Okay. So this was posted on the article that I saw on Ars Technica. It was posted on March 3rd. And we can look at the 5-day. Oh, and it, honestly, people didn't really seem to be bothered by it. So,
well, those are stockholders. They're not going to be bothered until people stop buying it.
Well, no, except for you talk about locking things down. You're restricting us. You know, you're restricting the supply. So, you're restricting the ability to build a market or like basically become a platform.
But this sort of leaves a gap now. I mean, some guy in Kickstarter could make a little thing saying, hey, we have Keurig-like machines, yeah. not Keurig yeah. machines, and they'll work with the old shitty K-cups.
All you have to do is fit that shape. Now, what Keurig could have done is license that design and in order to, like, you know, like what Apple, well, similar to what Apple does, right? Apple, you have to, like, license your products with them and stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. Keurig could have done that and said, that's fine. Anybody can make anything, and we're going to take, you know, 2 cents off of each.
That would have been better if you asked me.
And you license it. And then you're still enforcing yourself as a platform. You're allowing the market to kind of develop other things that it finds interesting, right? I mean, those chai tea things are awful, like horrifically bad. But I don't know. Maybe they're interesting. Maybe people like them. So mm-hmm. you're like building, you're allowing that stuff to develop and create. And who knows? And maybe they will. Maybe they will license the little chip that goes in there.
I have a little notebook and I keep track of the taste of K-Cups
mm-hmm.
that I have. And by far, the worst one I've ever had is the vanilla cappuccino K-Cup. Whatever you do, do not get that.
Is that the one where you looked at it afterwards and the cup was empty? Or is that like the I remember there was one.
That was the one.
And so basically it was just like concentrate that they just diluted.
Yeah, it was disgusting.
Ugh.
It was gross.
Yeah, so that's a terrible. Some of those are just terrible. Some of them are fairly decent. Now what my mom has for her K-cup and for her Keurig is she has like an insert that has a little little metal mesh filter in it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can grind your own coffee and put it in there and then brew it. So it's basically like then it becomes a really nice drip machine, which I've done that with some coffee that I've ground in that. And you get pretty close to where you get, I mean, it's still not as good as doing like a really good hand brew. But because Keurig, they're high quality machines, they hold the water temperature right where you need it to be with the right grind and with enough, you can actually get a pretty decent cup of coffee out of that. So for my brother, I'm actually shipping him my old grinder down to him in San Diego. And so they have that same little filter device. So now he can just go out and buy, you know, even crappy whole ground or whole beans are better than, you know, pre-ground anything. Mm-hmm. So now he can just run the grinder real quick.
I'm trying to question that assumption, by the way, that it sucks to pre-grind stuff. I've gotten a little bit of beans from Kuma, and I have one which I don't grind, and mm-hmm. I have a section of those beans that I've mm-hmm. sort of partitioned off, and I've pre-ground those.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then, I randomly just pick a set, and I brew from that.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know what's going to be.
Yeah.
I know if it's going to be like pre-ground or if it's going to be ground after, like on the spot. But at the same time, I haven't personally noticed a big difference in taste. So I don't know if that is something that I just haven't developed yet in my palate.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I don't think it makes a big difference if I pre-grind my coffee or not. Now, how long it's pre-ground for is different.
Yeah, of course.
I haven't done that test yet.
So how long do you, like, how long do you define, quote-unquote, pre-ground? Like
I drink that coffee. I grind it within 48 hours. So it's within 48 hours of grinding it.
You know, that's a really interesting question. I know there's been a lot of work there's been some interesting research and stuff on this and what's better, pre-ground or whole bean. You know what would be interesting is we should bring one of my friend, Matt Hodson, mm-hmm. is a barista over at Zoka. I think he's at Aura Bakery now. It'd be interesting to, you know, bring him on. And he does a lot of like home espresso training and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. like maybe ask him some of these kind of come up with the ultimate coffee Q&A and have him answer a lot of this type of stuff.
It'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, it might just be my palate. I may not have developed it yet, but...
Well, it's the point of not of pre-grinding is that what you want is the oils, right? And those oils dry out. And so as you grind, as your particulate size goes down, what is this, a square cube law? So you're increasing the amount of surface area in which you can do evaporation and stuff. So you're drying out your beans, basically.
Right.
And then you're letting those oils escape. So that's the traditional.
But those are natural oils. Natural oils. I wonder if you can synthetically, like, put something tasteless, like ground nut oil, into your coffee and see if it makes the flavor taste a bit better. Just the look on your face, you're like, that's so unorthodox.
You just said, I'm going to put synthetic I'm gonna put synthetic stuff, oil in my like.
I did synthetic biology for a few months. I have no fear.
All right, you know what? Organisms. We should do this. We should do like the we should do like a coffee brew off or something like that, and like just try a bunch of random like test kitchen or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I have some friends I think that could like totally help us out.
Awesome.
With that, and like my Nate Jones, who makes the. Makes the S filter.
Yep.
Yeah, he would. He'd be totally down to do some. If we like had a list of like random coffee, he's tried a whole bunch of random crap.
Well, and, if oil really is what gives coffee that awesome flavor when you grind it at the moment, I wonder if you can just add it in if you pre-grind your coffee and get the same effect.
There is something I'll have to find this. There is like a center for there's like a place that does like scientific research on like coffee beans and all of this stuff, and like they publish a bunch of papers on breaking down what beans are like what and what they're constituted of. And
I'll make a multiple regression model if I have to.
There you go. All right, we need to. Okay, so we keep dancing around this. We need to get like a coffee episode. So we'll have to do it at some point when we bring in some of these guys and we can like do some interviews, and then we'll live. I mean, obviously we'll record us through this whole thing and then edit it down to make it nicer. But that'd be kind of fun to do like a test kitchen, a coffee test kitchen.
Yep, a number of different hypotheses, and we'll test each one.
Yeah. All right. Let's try and do this. This will be fun. So speaking of live streaming some things, you wanted us to put on our like hard hats, right?
Yeah. So I was basically walking around in my office all the time here.
Mm-hmm.
I walk around a lot, and everyone's kind of looking at me like, why are you walking around? You're supposed to be working at your desk.
Yeah.
And the only other person who walks around with me and does fun stuff like jumping around every now and then is Margot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because she understands that it's unhealthy to be sitting down all day. And she actually goes out of her way to, stand up out of her desk and, like, jump and make everybody else jump, too, if she can. So I wanted to see if I could somehow get a standing desk. And obviously, they're very expensive.
Yeah.
Like, I asked Heidi about it, and she was just like, $800 for a desk? I don't think so. Like, that's not going
to happen. Is that how much they were?
Yeah. Wow. The cheapest standing desk is $800. That's what we found. So what we ended up doing was I thought there must be an alternative. And I went to the internet, and I found that some guy out there – and it wasn't just this guy, but there were a number of people who had similar problems. But this guy, what he did was he got a bunch of spare IKEA parts and he made a standing desk for $22.
$22?
Yep.
Wow.
It's just like one small kind of square table, mm-hmm. and then a couple of shelf brackets, which he's screwed on there.
Yeah.
And then a small 12-inch shelf for your mouse and keyboard. And then you put your monitor on top of that table, and you put that table on top of your desk. And you can, of course, you have to measure out, like, where your hands are supposed to go and how tall it's going to be. But you can adjust it. It's all adjustable because you're making it yourself. And for less than $25, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
It's going to take maybe a half hour to make once you get the parts.
Yeah.
So that's a big win.
Yeah. So to tie this into my really awkward transition of live streaming, we had talked about real briefly about, doing the same thing of, boys and their toy, geeks and power tools or something like that, and having us a weekend or a Saturday afternoon drive down to IKEA, buy a bunch of parts, buy a bunch of beer, and with some sort of circular saw and
beer and power tools,
right?
Exactly. That might be a bad combination,
right? And so then recording that and seeing if anything interesting came out of that, and doing a little recap of our adventure. So I am incredibly mechanical. You're like actually good at this kind of stuff. I am like entirely mechanically challenged.
Well, I took wood shop for years.
Yeah.
I loved wood shop.
I took one wood shop from a professor or from a teacher that really liked me, and I really liked him, and I still got like a C-.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You must have just been afraid for your safety.
I think so. It was bad. But anyways, this sounds like something that would be... I looked at the instructions and I was like, so easy, even Nick Robinson can do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know why he included instructions. He didn't need to, really. You could just look at it and go, okay, I know how to build that.
Yeah.
But it's still very clever, and it's something that's really worth doing. So I'm going to go ahead and build that for myself at home. And if it works out at home, I'm going to sort of smoke test it there. And if it works out at home, I'm going to build one for work here.
Okay, cool.
But we need to get like a tape measure and figure out how tall the desk is at work and at home, and we need to have those measurements. But
because that's the thing is we have, you know, with our desks here, we have the storage cabinets above it, and that with the height might be a little bit of an interesting thing.
I actually tried that. I tried to actually open up my storage cabinet, put my computer in there, and kind of work. But the problem is I had to lean over.
Yeah.
So my back started to hurt first off and second off, the screen, the cabinet was not big enough to actually hold my 13-inch MacBook.
Yeah,
I had to actually like have it sort of half folded.
Okay,
which was again like very awkward. Yeah,
you also need those anti-shock mats, right? Like, because you're standing all day, don't you need like those? Like, they have them behind like the bar, like bars and stuff like that. So they're like or at the checkout counters for people who are on their feet the whole day.
I did not know about that. Yeah. But that's cool.
I desperately wanted one of those during this conference last week because I was on my feet. We would start, registration started at 7 a.m. and would close at 5:30. And you're standing there the whole time, aside from your 30-minute lunch break or 45-minute lunch break. And the end of the first day, I hurt really bad. It was not good. So I was hoping for one of those kind of mats. But I've looked at doing standing desks for a while. I think they'd be really interesting. I think I would like to be able to transition back and forth. And so if there was, even something that was like light and movable that I could like set up, okay, now I'm going to be standing desk or now I'm going to be sitting, I think would be interesting, at least to help with that transition period.
Well, it wouldn't be a smooth transition, but it would take you just a minute to pull your monitor down and put it on top of your real desk.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of the stuff that's kind of come? There's been recently been a little bit of a pushback against standing desks. Have you read any of that stuff?
No. I guess I've heard that it doesn't make a difference in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you're just as likely to get hip problems or whatever it is. There was a study out of some school that said that. I've heard a rumor about that. But at the same time, the reason I want to do it is because I like to walk around. I actually like the movement. So I guess I'm doing it more for a like free kind of lifestyle, energy type thing,
mm-hmm.
not really for health per se.
Yeah. And I think that does make a difference. So,
and we are, in a collaborative environment. I want to be able to, just walk up to somebody else and talk to them and walk back. So,
yeah, interesting. Well, it sounds like an interesting project. So we'll have to keep people updated on how that goes.
Yeah, I also wanted to mention, and this is kind of, it might be a different topic or it might not be. I'm always talking about, a need to do list or a need to do app. I found something called Google Keep. And I think it's been around for quite a while, but I've just discovered it myself, and it's been really useful. It's like I can't describe it. It's like a in-browser Evernote type thing.
Okay.
That's the closest I can get to describing it. It's kind of, you can basically add a note, and the note can be turned into a list, like a checklist type of a thing, or it could not. But the layout looks kind of like Pinterest, little blocks.
Yeah, or a little bit like Trello.
I think this tool can be used in many different ways. I ended up using it like Trello.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be used that way. It could be used just to sort of document pictures and web pages that you found, and you can just add them as notes. Or you can do what I do and make to-do lists and make, basically, I use them as little sticky notes, each one a different color. And that's been working out for me. I can get up in the morning and look at exactly what I need to do in different projects, and with a little more metadata, I can add in here, I can figure out a lot of things about my things to do. Like, so I can go apply for housing for next year. So that means I also have to get that done by, based off what I've written here, March 9th, but I can do it sooner. And it's going to take me about 10 minutes to do. So that's something I can do immediately.
Cool.
Things like that. So again, it's just, I'm using GTD, but I'm using it in this new interface.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I've heard about Google Keep. I haven't used it very much, but I have some friends that have been, talking it up and saying they really like it. It's really effective and useful for them. And, now Google is happy, I'm sure, to get more of your information about what you do day in and day out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But at least now we know that they aren't giving it to the NSA.
That's true.
Or trying not to.
that's right. Well, what was that? Was it RightsCon? Was that conference that came out and they basically said encrypt their guiding principle was encrypt everything.
But I mean, come on, encryption is not the answer to everything.
No, and it's more of just like a deterrent kind of like.
Yeah.
Just, screw you.
But it doesn't really, it doesn't solve the problem. It just kind of makes it harder for people.
It doesn't solve the problem. It helps to try and prevent something that people think is, or that is an issue. But no, you're right. It does not solve that fundamental issue.
It sounds more like a PR campaign to me.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there's some things that are quite, that are good about it. So there's a lot that we just send, you know, it just gets sent in plain text over the internet, which is like, okay, it might be worth at least like putting a little bit of encryption on this. But yeah, but I think it's, that's a lot of computational load. That's a lot of, one of the things is that when you're forced something like this, people, because it's such a massive load on systems, not even from a technical perspective, but just turning all this stuff on, monitoring certificates, like, people find ways to, like, to just kind of get by. And I think that, in a sense of, you're implementing cryptography or security, but it may not necessarily be good security.
Mm-hmm.
And you may just be doing it really crappily. And then you're putting in a false sense of confidence over over what it used to be. So I remember I was reading a number of years ago, Cessna's twin engine planes had a higher fatality rate than their single engine planes. Not because their single engine or double engine planes were less safe. In fact, they were way safer. They had redundant systems and all this stuff. But people took many more risks when they would go back and analyze the crashes. They found that a lot of these were, like, quote unquote, avoidable.
Mm-hmm.
In that everybody, people were taking more risks than they would in a single engine plane because they thought that they had that fallback. And so we're reading about stuff where, like, CryptoChat, that, you know, chat program that people have been using, like, that has a huge fatal flaw, like, in it that basically just disables the security. I mean, and kind of like all this stuff that goes through, it's, people look at it and they think that because that security, it's free and safe, and they're not nearly as careful, and then end up with a flaw, and they're like, oh my, we've been exposing everything on here.
You know, if people want to be safe, like, for real, what they got to do is make up their own cryptography and then send messages to that, their own cryptography. And even if it's intercepted by a third party, you know, entity like the NSA, they're not going to have the key to that crypto because, you know, it's not going to be like Google has it. It's not going to be like they have it. And they'll have to come to you to get it.
Well, that's the idea with you know, public-private key exchange.
Right.
That you have your key and you send somebody your public key. The problem is, it's not that some of the algorithms are really trivial to break now, but there's a lot that aren't, and we can keep moving. You know, we have ECC, elliptical curve cryptography or whatever. It's like way more complicated. I don't understand it. The math's really deep. But what they're finding is that it's not that we're breaking these algorithms, it's that we're breaking the implementations.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is not picking a good cryptography algorithm. It's not, you know, getting a key generated. It's doing the whole system in a way that doesn't leak numbers or leak information. I mean, they were looking at one where it was basically like, if you just smash an XOR, I can't remember which one it was or the details, if I could smash an XOR function against it like 20,000 times, you can extract the information out of it and you can pull the key out. In fact, there was a paper that came out, a terrifying paper that came out where looking at EC2, where some Johns Hopkins researchers, I think it was Johns Hopkins, were able to basically put a VM resident on the machine, and they can pull everybody's cryptography keys based on the timings of hitting the CPU. So they would just start emitting a string of operations, mm-hmm. and they were able to, the paper's fascinating, it's brilliant. They were able to figure out when, because basic cryptography is basically just like XORing stuff, and an XOR takes a fixed amount of time. So based on the latency of what they were doing, based on the operations that the people were submitting in their VM,
mm-hmm.
in the attack VM, they were able to figure out when an XOR operation was being fired off in another person's VM. And doing this over hours and hours and hours, they were able to extract the key from the latency timings.
Very clever.
Brilliant.
Very, very clever.
Brilliant. But you look at that and you go, what can I do? Like, there's nothing that I can do, like, to combat. There was a little bit. So they patched. So this was with the Zen hypervisor, which has since been patched and I think Amazon updated. But basically they just were, they blocked it. So, and that's a really common thing with a failure of cryptography, is that if the system fails, it returns, and it returns really fast. So then you know that you failed. So now they're padding the return timing. So there's consistent timing. So they're fixing things like that. But you just, I mean, I could be running this on Amazon with my own stuff, like taking care of everything on my end, and I'm still getting nailed by the fact that it's hitting the CPU cache wrong.
Yep.
The instruction cache is what's giving me away.
It's not in your control.
My gosh.
Yeah, you know, we have, it's a very complicated system that we have and a very complicated world that we live in. So not everything's going to be your fault, but you're going to feel the heat from that. And at the same time, you know, vice versa can also be true. So I'm not sure what the right solution is, but I do think that at the end of the day, security is your personal issue. If you want your stuff to be secure, you have to find a way to do it. And yeah. Unfortunately, we're not readily equipped to do that because we're not always taught cryptography, you know, as a basic life skill. So I don't know, but at the same time, I don't think it's terribly difficult to create your own. And like you mentioned, we do have public and private keys and other types of mechanisms like that. And I think that if people did take cryptography into their own hands, like if I had a certain crypto line that I would use between you and me for our email communications and a different one for me and my parents, you would not, even if, you know, somebody was to intercept that information, they wouldn't be able to decrypt that because I would have the actual decryption, like,
because you're holding the keys. They just get your public key,
right?
Which,
but if Google is the one that's going to say all the stuff happening through Google, and Google is the one that actually has the Rosetta Stone, then the NSA or whoever can just say, hey, hand over this key, and yes, it's encrypted, but we'll decrypt it. It's just one more step for us to do. Big deal. So for true security, you have to kind of hang on to your own keys there.
Yeah, and there's a whole variance between there's so much gray area between I'm connecting to an unencrypted public Wi-Fi network with my firewall down and like just happily dinging around and logging into my banks and all this stuff, than to like go in full like air gapped secured computer stuff locked in safes. Like, and no system is perfect, but I think that there's a lot that we need to do more work in figuring out what is common sense simple cryptography. So have you ever used S/MIME and attached a certificate to your emails? It's really not that hard, but there's a few steps involved.
I don't know what that is.
So S/MIME is it's like secure message. What is it? What does MIME stand for? Like message interface or something like that. So basically, S/MIME is the secure onto that. So you attach. So you generate a certificate and you attach your public key to it, and then when you send it to me, we exchange keys, and then I sign everything with my I can't remember exactly what it was, but basically we sign our keys and we send them back and forth, and I sign it and send you a copy of my key, and then I would sign it with your key, and you can decrypt it with your private, with your public key, and then you can sign it with your, you can decrypt it with your private key. And so then basically, you send out your little key with all your stuff, and people can encrypt stuff for you, but they can't decrypt it without.
Interesting. So do companies do this with their emails?
Like, some places do. Again, the problem is if there's no corresponding key, I don't get any security. I can't sign it, and so it'll go. I can't do the handshake. I can't do the key exchange. So we exchange. So I want to send you an email, and we do a key exchange where I get yours and I sign the email with your public key, which then you can decrypt with your private key. If you don't have it on the other end, then it just goes in plain text.
Right.
So it's actually very difficult to do good signing and everything. And to do it, you need to have a key that's signed. To have a good key, you need to have a key that's signed by a valid certificate authority. So Starcom will give out free keys, but that process is a little bit involved. And so I had it working, but actually what I found was that nobody used it. So in reality, I would send it, and then they would be confused by the fact that all my emails had a key attached to it. That was my crypto key.
Well, kudos for being ahead of the curve there.
Yeah, so it's interesting. But so the point is, I think we need to do more work on getting people up to that kind of speed and to pay attention to those things and really figure out what helps and what doesn't. Does signing emails help or hinder? I don't know. I don't exchange all that much information, secure information with people, so.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess. But you know, you would think that a lot of the people who work in the med school or in hospitals would be using S-MIME to.
You would, yeah, you would think, well, yeah, and so they do that a little bit with their mail servers and stuff. You can't forward emails to like Google and stuff like that. So you have to use their secure servers, which they maintain encryption links at least between the other servers and stuff like that. So there's lots of things that happen there. But
interesting. Well, maybe after this podcast, I can look up some S-MIME stuff and learn about it a bit more, and maybe get my own little crypto key.
Yeah, and why don't you, if you want to, yeah, maybe then let us know how that goes for you. I'd be interested to hear what your response is.
Yep.
So, now speaking of that, you've been working on some other stuff as well. You were working on, you're working on a lot with like D3 and Neo4j, right? We were talking about that last week. You finally got it working, right?
I did. I finally did get all that protein-protein interaction data into Neo4j, all 500 million nodes. And there was like about 3 million.
Oh, sorry. Oh, how many nodes?
500,000.
Okay.
You must have heard 500 million. That's what I think I said.
Yes.
Yeah, I was like, holy smokes, 500,000 nodes. But we did have like about 4 million edges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was a pretty heavy graph.
Yeah.
But after I got it in there, I didn't really do too much. I guess what I did end up doing was looking for the shortest path between certain nodes. And that was very, very quick. It took less than a second on this really dense, heavy graph. So kudos to all the Neo4j guys for making some amazing software, because the size of graphs, you know, don't really matter as much anymore as they used to.
Great.
That's saying a lot, because think about it. Like, you know, as you get more and more nodes, the computation time of any kind of query you do is supposed to like increase quadratically. It's disgustingly inefficient.
Yeah.
But now it's like very, very doable.
That's awesome. Very cool. And then were you able to? I know you were trying to do some visualization with D3. Did you get that working?
Yeah, I was trying to play with some. I've been working with lots of bioinformatics data, again, bioinformatician, lots of DNA data, and I wanted to get this data into D3 and visualize it. So I've almost got it working. I've got like the plot laid out, got the data points on the plot, but there are a few bugs here and there that I'm still working through to get this to work. It looks like right now what I've seen is that I have like on the scatter plot that I have, the x-axis is being read perfectly, but the y-axis is being read in as NANDs. So it seems like a pretty straightforward fix.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a half hour or so of debugging it, I'll get it to work.
Mm-hmm.
So
now how do you like debugging code in JavaScript?
I hate it. It's terrible.
Yeah.
That's the hardest part. But you know, I come from the world of scripting, so it's not like I have a debugger anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like with Python, it's just a matter of like print statements and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of used to that mode of just using console.log in JavaScript and just printing stuff out and seeing what's in there.
Mm-hmm. That's what I like, you know, that's how I end up doing it as well. But sometimes I want to be able to do like, to look at what variables are holding or peer into objects and stuff. And
I think there actually is a JavaScript library, like a node.js library out there that helps you step through code.
It's, you know, it. I know they have one, I just haven't really I haven't really dug into it too much. And so theoretically, I thought that using that in Eclipse, using Node Eclipse, it would let me do some of that kind of stuff. And maybe I just have it set up wrong, but I find it to be just an absolute pain to step through. And the other thing is just working with the asynchronous model and stuff like that is really difficult. Some things just really don't work very well. We don't fit well into the node mentality.
Well, Python still exists for a reason.
Python does still exist for a reason. You know, and I'm moving. I'm definitely realizing that there's absolute, you know, need for like these procedural languages, stuff like that, that work a little bit more more in the traditional kind of sense. And so I've been working on some projects right now that are basically doing one thing is like scheduling data pulls and stuff like that. Like I just want to run it every like 30 minutes or whatever, run, go out, fetch some new data and bring it back in. And so Node kind of has support for cron jobs, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do it, you have to like, yeah, basically fire. Excuse me. You have to like fire it into like a cron process or whatever, and like fire up another version, another system of Node, another like instance of Node, run that and then kill it. And so that's a little bit, it's less easy than just saying, like, you know, go, I don't know, just go run this, you know, run this script or, you know, on this time, go and run this binary or something like that. It's a little bit, you can feel like, it's not that you can't do it, but you feel like you're definitely moving outside of what Node was designed to do.
Well, the thing with Node, I think, is that you have to roll your own version of a lot of different things that you kind of take for granted.
Yeah.
Like in Python, we have that, one of my favorite commands in Python on the terminal is python-m simple HTTP server. You just like fire up a random server and, you know, in that directory that you're working in, and you have a server that's working. You can go to localhost, you can debug stuff,
mm-hmm.
it'll get, it'll post, it'll do all of that.
Yeah.
Now, Node, as far as I know, does not have something like that built into it.
Well, no, it has Express.
Well, you have to, I mean, I had to write my own little simple HTTP server and like,
really?
Program to get and post requests, and that, you know, worked, but that's not something I've done before. So I was going to say that I think Node is, it's nifty, but it's also for, like, quote-unquote real programmers. It's for people who are, you know, like to roll their own version of literally everything.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some truth to that. I know that Node has all that stuff, yeah, built into it, but you have to, yeah, fire it up and do the, like, yeah, you have to instantiate the http.request or something and pipe it to array, you know. That is a big bit of a pain. So Express, the framework, takes care of a lot of that stuff for you, which is quite nice. But yeah, it's just, you know, it's good for it does what it does, and it does it quite well. But then there's definitely times where you realize that you're just not designed to. You have to get into a really different mindset of thinking. So like Java, Node is all asynchronous, right? So you're like, okay, I want to send off this GET request to go hit this REST API, and then I want to return it. It's asynchronous, right? So the program doesn't wait. It just keeps executing. But you're like, oh, wait a minute. I want to, like, get those results, put it in a variable, and do some operation on it, right? You have to, like, you're piping yourself into, you're just, like, nesting yourself further and further into this function. And then you have to, like, you can't just tell it to, like, return because then the... Right, because then that section is already, well, I've already executed. It's moving on to the next iteration, right? It doesn't wait for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you do a little bit of a timeout, but that says just like, okay, hold on for a second, now keep going. And you can't sleep because sleep halts the whole process, which will block everything else. So it definitely requires a way of thinking about it beyond just saying, go out and grab this thing and then return it to this variable and move on and process it. In a sense, it's kind of like going back to an analogy that I can think of is going to, if you ever written in VHDL or Verilog, right, writing very high speed hardware descriptor language, like writing like actual like chips and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, everything is live at once. There's no holding, no waiting. So it's literally electricity flowing through circuits. And so you're kind of like piping that around. And in a sense, JavaScript is not nearly that arcane and ridiculous. You're not looking at like, at literal voltage patterns to find out if you got your output correct. But there is definitely a sense of which you are kind of like flowing data around, and you have to keep in mind that everything is all executing it in these different circles, and then you try and like converge them and move off. So in a sense, that's really great when you need to execute, when somebody needs to hit your server, right? They hit it and it just like executes through this train and then comes back in. Or I found that it's less useful for is like loading, is like doing big data loads and like pulling stuff in, because you want to just like say, okay, I just want to roll in, I want to load in all this data from this API or something like that, and then pre-populate everything. Now I'm basically in read mode with some writes and stuff, but now I'm doing this all in the web client, like loading things in as like an administrator or something is a little bit more difficult to do, and is kind of like just trying to process all of that stuff in your mind. It's not nearly as easy as just like writing a thing in Go or SQL and letting it run.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, it's funny that the biggest advantage of Node is also the biggest disadvantage in the way that you have described it. Like, you know, a lot of JavaScript GUIs would lock up because they weren't asynchronous.
Yeah.
They'd have to wait for a callback.
Yeah.
And Node allows for it to be asynchronous, so you can do some clever programming and make your web apps very, very fast,
mm-hmm.
and very, very cool. But yeah, when it comes to sort of running a backend script, it can be a big pain.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out better ways to do that kind of stuff. And But really, you know, it's just learning the way that Node does things and figuring all of that stuff out. And so it's been a little bit of a learning curve. But some stuff is just so easy. It's just kind of amazing. I mean, with Angular, you're just like, here you go. Here's this DOM object, and I just want you to throw everything there, and we're gonna set up this partial and just iterate this HTML script for each of these objects in this array that I've pulled from.
I still haven't used Angular or Express, but I have played with Ember a bit, and that's been interesting. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, definitely. All right, before we, because we're getting kind of close, before we're done, I want to jump down to this Jurassic system that you sent me. What is this thing? Tell us about this.
So remember in Jurassic Park how there was that Unix computer system that they were playing with?
Of course I do.
Trying to shut down like the power in the park because it was all locked up. And then they had to like reboot things, and that system, somebody out there has actually programmed it into a web browser, like a web app, and you can actually play with it. They have the exact same image of that lady, like that little zebra. Was it a zebra's? Like
yeah, laying on like the zebra dress. Couch or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, they have that. They have it in there, so you can like you can actually be that guy who programs that computer and gets that little error. Kind of a dumb, fun app.
Okay, but were you as, when you were watching that movie, did you just want to be that guy, like, surrounded by all these computer screens, like, controlling the world at your fingertips?
At that age, no. I did not. Well, I started out as a biologist. I still am a biologist, I would say. So, I don't know. Like, I was more into, like, the actual dinosaurs and the DNA and, like...
The guys, like, creating the stuff in the lab?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I wanted to be... What's his name? Nebly, something like that. I wanted to be that guy. I mean, it just was like, oh, that sounds so cool.
Jeff Goldblum. That's who I wanted to be. Like,
yes.
You know, life finds a way.
Yeah, the chaos theory.
Yep.
You know he suffers from a deplorable excess of personality, right?
Oh, yeah. But that's not really a bad thing.
No, but, oh, man, I just... This guy had all the power right there. It's like, oh, it's going to be compiling for the next, like, 10 hours. Man, that's, like, what real systems got to do, right? Compile for 10 hours.
Exactly.
Which I think is maybe, that's, like, that's what children think, right? Because that's why they created Go, right? Ken Thompson, those guys were like, we're sick of waiting for C++ to compile. So while it's compiling, we're going to write this other language because we are Ken Thompson and Rob Pike, and we can just do that.
Yep.
But anyways, that was really cool. So thank you for sending me that. It's amazing what you can write into a browser these days.
Isn't Ken Thompson just known as Ken?
Just Ken, yeah. I probably. I remember I was watching a video.
He's like Madonna. He's just Ken.
He's Madonna. I don't think there's anybody, maybe Wozniak, but I don't think there's anybody further from Madonna than Ken Thompson. I remember I was watching a video. They did like a Q&A with the Go team 2 years ago, or whatever, at Google I.O. And they're going down the line and introducing everybody. Like, I'm Andrew Garon, and I'm Ken Thompson, or I'm Rob Pike. And he goes, hello, I'm Ken Thompson. And it's just like applause. Like,
really?
Ken Thompson, right? And he kind of like goes back and he's like, no, I think he said, hi, I'm Ken. And I was like, and he's kind of like looking around like, what on earth is what I'm
That's doing, so funny.
Right? And he's interesting. He's just going, happily into retirement and thinking around on things that he cares about. And like,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It'd be cool to meet that guy one day.
I would love to meet that guy.
Is he in Mountain View, or do you know where he is?
I think he's in Mountain View. I mean, who knows?
Is he in Seattle?
I don't think that he's in Seattle. Actually, I think the Go team is based out of Sydney, but I think that, I think Ken is in Mountain View. Although, you know what, he's probably on wherever he wants to be.
Yeah.
Well, let's track him down and be like, Ken, I'll buy you a beer.
Yeah, it'd be cool. Yeah. It never hurts to send someone an email like that, because you never know, they could just say yes.
Yeah, who did we meet a couple months ago?
Stanley Gartler.
Stanley Gartler,
the Gila Bomb guy.
The Gila Bomb guy. That was... What a boss, too. He was, like, totally with it.
Yeah, so the Gila Bomb was basically back in the 1970s, and I guess the NIH was funding a lot of cancer research, and it was all being done on this one cell line called Gila. And Gila is short for Henrietta Lacks, who was the cancer patient who they got this cell line from. And all the research was done on this one line, and Stanley Gartler proved that there was a heavy, heavy bias just because of that cell line. And, you know, it's like a lot of the research that they've done had been curing cancer for that line specifically, not for curing cancer, which is why a lot of the therapies were not working in people, but they were working in the lab. So that was a big deal. Everybody hated him for a long time.
Yeah.
But now that he's kind of like a local hero.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was proven to be right. And his thing was contamination too, right? Because like even if you were places where you were working on other cell lines, it was found out that they were contaminated with with this HeLa line. But I think it was really cool. You know, you go and you talk to this guy and you're like, how do you get yourself into a position where the scientific community is going one way and you're like, oh my gosh, they're wrong. Like full stop, wrong.
Right. And he did this at a conference. He went to an actual huge conference and he got up on stage and told everybody who had a lot more money than he did.
And a lot more, you know, quote unquote, prestige. I mean, there were Nobel laureates and people were winning awards for this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And he just got up there and said, you're wrong. And, you know, everything you've done is for naught.
Yeah.
And he could prove it. So you can imagine the disdain that people had for him.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. So I think it was interesting for us to talk to him about, you know, how do you continue on with something where you think you have a right idea and other people maybe are discouraging you or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just how to be an impactful scientist.
And he's 90-something now.
He's 90-something.
And he still comes to UW every day and does his thing in the lab.
Just puttering around, you know. And he's like, oh, yeah, they let me hang around. And, you know, he's kind of self-deprecating, right? He's like, yeah, they just let me fart around and do whatever.
Uh-huh.
I don't do anything, but they let me have a desk, so.
Yeah.
It was funny. But, yeah, I mean, we just sent him an email, right? Just like over beers one night. We're just like, here you go.
Exactly. Really
so,
cool guy.
So if we ever track down Ken Thompson, gonna buy him a beer.
Exactly.
Yep. Alrighty, well, we're right at an hour, so this was I enjoyed this conversation. I think we covered a lot of interesting things. So.
Yeah, me too.
All right, well, folks, we will see you again next week because both of us are in town, so we will be free to do all of that stuff. Again, let us hit us up on Twitter at Informatonauts and Nick Robison and Nikhil Gopal as well. And please let us know if you have any topics you want us to cover, any papers that you've read that think are interesting or want to get our insight on. Anything else, feel free to drop us a line, and we look forward to modifying and improving as we go along. So,
all right. Well, I think you pretty much all, you just summed it all up. So I'm just going to say goodbye, and thanks for listening, folks.